I want to begin by reading a little story that is apparently true. The author of the article affirms that it is true. It says, Marshall Steinberger was a methodical man of nearly 50, with bushy white hair, guileless brown eyes, and the bouncing enthusiasm of a Tsardist dancer in his native Hungary. He always took the 909 Long Island Railroad train from his suburban home to Woodinville, New York, where he caught the subway into the city. On the morning of January 10th, 1948, Sternberger boarded the 909 as usual. En route, he suddenly decided to visit Lazio Victor, a Hungarian friend who lived in Brooklyn as well. Accordingly, at Ozone Park, Sternberger changed to the subway for Brooklyn, went to his friend's house, and stayed until mid-afternoon. He then boarded the Manhattan-bound subway for his Fifth Avenue office, and here is his story. The car was crowded. There seemed to be no chance of a seat. But just as I entered, a man sitting by the door suddenly jumped up to leave. I slipped into the empty space. I'd been living in New York long enough not to start conversations with strangers. But being a photographer, I have the peculiar habit of analyzing people's faces. I was struck by the features of the passenger on my left. He was probably in his late 30s, and when he glanced up, his eyes seemed to have a hurt expression on them. He was reading a Hungarian language newspaper, and something prompted me to say to him in Hungarian, I hope you don't mind if I glance at your paper. The man seemed surprised to be addressed in his native language, but he answered politely, you may read it now. I'll have time later on. During the half-hour train ride to town, we had quite a conversation. He said his name was Bekla Toskin, a law student when World War II started. He had been put in the German labor battalion and sent to the Ukraine. Later, he was captured by the Russians, put to work burying the German dead. After the war, he covered hundreds of miles on foot until he reached his home in Debrecen, a large city in eastern Hungary. I myself knew Debrecen quite well. We talked about it for a while. He told me the rest of his story. When he went to the apartment, once occupied by his father, mother, brothers, and sisters, he found strangers living there. He went upstairs to the apartment where he and his wife had once had. It was also occupied by strangers. None of them had ever heard of his family. As he was leaving full of sadness, a boy ran after him calling, Toskin Box, Toskin Box. That means Uncle Toskin. The child was the son of some old neighbors of his. He went to the boy's home, talked to his parents. Your whole family is dead, they told him. The Nazis took them and your wife to Auschwitz. Auschwitz was one of the worst Nazi concentration camps. Toskin gave up all hope. A few days later, too heartsick to remain any longer in Hungary, he set out on foot, steering across the border until he finally reached Paris, and he managed to eventually immigrate to the United States in October of 1947, just 3 months before I met him. All the time he'd been talking, I kept thinking that somehow his story seemed familiar. A young woman whom I had met recently at the home of friends had also been from Debrecen. She had been sent to Auschwitz. From there, she had been transferred to work in a German munitions factory. Her relatives had been killed in the gas chambers. Later, she was liberated by the Americans and was brought here in the first boatload of displaced persons in 1946. Her story had moved me so much that I had written down her address and phone number, intending to invite her to meet my family and thus help relieve the terrible emptiness in her life. It seemed impossible there could be any connection between these two people, but at a nearby station, I fumbled anxiously in my address book. I asked in a casual voice, what was your wife's name? Was it Maria? He turned pale. Yes, he said. How did you know? He looked as if I was about to faint. I said, let's get out of the train. I took him by the arm at the next station and led him to a phone booth. He stood there like a man in a trance when I dialed her phone number. It seemed hours before Marina Toskin answered. Later, I learned that her room was alongside the telephone, but she was in the habit of never answering it because she had so few phone calls from so few friends. This time it rang so long, she finally answered the phone. When I heard her voice at last, I told her who I was, and I asked her to describe her husband. She seemed surprised at the question, but gave me a description. Then I asked where she had lived in Debrecen, Hungary, and she told me the address. Asking her to hold the line, I turned to Toskin and said, do you and your wife live on such and such a street? Yes, he said. He was white as a sheet and trembling. Try to be calm, I urged him. Something miraculous is about to happen to you. Here, take this telephone and talk to your wife. He nodded his head in mute bewilderment. His eyes bright with tears, he took the receiver, listened a moment to his wife's voice, then suddenly cried, "This is Bilah. This is my Bilah." I'm sorry. He began to mumble hysterically. Seeing that the poor man was so excited and couldn't talk coherently, I took the receiver from his hands. "Stay where you are," he said, Maria, who also sounded hysterical. "I'm sending your husband to you. We'll be there in a few minutes." Bela was crying like a baby and saying over and over again, "This is my wife. I go to my wife." At first, I thought I'd better accompany Kafkin, lest the man should faint from excitement. Understatement. But I decided this was a moment in which no strangers should intrude. Putting Kafkin into his taxi cab, I directed the driver to take him to Maria's address, and I paid the fare and said goodbye. Bela Paskin's reunion with his wife was a moment so poignant, so electric, and so suddenly released emotion that afterwards neither he nor Mariah could even recall much about it. I remember only that when I left the phone, I walked to the mirror like a dream to see if maybe my car or my hair had turned gray, she said later. The next thing I know, a taxi cab stopped in front of my house. It is my husband who comes toward me, a man I had not seen in many years. Even now, it's difficult to believe that it happened. We have both suffered so much. I have almost lost the capability not to be afraid. Each time my husband goes from the house, I say to my house, will anything take him from me again? Her husband is confident that no horrible misfortune will ever again befall them. Providence, he said, has brought us together. He says simply, it was meant to be. Now, everybody involved in that story says it's true, that that's exactly how things happen, that the man just on spur of the moment decided to go to a different place that day, saw a man in this subway in New York, very proud of reading a Hungarian newspaper, and he was able to get a husband and wife who had been separated for a number of years back together. Obviously, that was not just time and chance. And I want to ask the question today, does time and chance happen to Christians? We sometimes turn to a scripture in Ecclesiastes, and I want to begin by going there in Ecclesiastes chapter 9. This scripture sometimes, I believe, has been misquoted, or at least misapplied. So where we say, well, this time and chance happens to all, and we throw our hands up, and that's like the end of the story in deciding what happened or why it happened. It's, well, time and chance happens to everybody. You know, we all get cold, we all get sick, we all have accidents, we all go broke, we all whatever it might be. But is that what the author of Ecclesiastes 9 is really saying? And once we are called by God, is it true that time and chance continues to happen to us in the same way? I submit that the Bible teaches it does not. That once God calls us, that we are in a special category of being in His care. And that He does orchestrate from time to time events in our life. He does intervene. He does answer our prayers, and we are no longer simply having time and chance happen to us in the same way. In Ecclesiastes chapter 9, let's begin in verse 1. Actually, we should begin back in verse 16 of chapter 8. That's where this actually begins. The chapter break probably would be better located after verse 15 of chapter 8. So the author of Solomon says, "I applied my heart to know wisdom, to see the business that's done on the earth, even though no one sees, no sleep nor night. I saw all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that's done under the sun." So he's applying his heart to know wisdom. He wants to understand, why do things befall men? He says, though a man labors to discover it, yet he will not find it. Moreover, though a wise man attempts to know it, he will not be able to find it. So this is a very difficult thing, to understand the comings and goings of people. Chapter 9 and verse 1, "I considered all this in my heart so that I could declare it all, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God." Now that is the beginning statement of this chapter. That he could declare that the righteous, the wise, and their works are in the hand of God. That's different than just simply saying, well, time and chance happens to all. He's saying, no, once people are called to be righteous, when they're trying to follow God, seek wisdom, their works, what they do, and what befalls them are in the hand of God. People know neither love nor hatred by anything they see before them. You don't know whether God loves you or hates you by what you see before you. You don't know whether or not those emotions are penalty or blessings, although I think sometimes we do understand, especially the blessing side. He says in verse 2, now the beginning of this chapter is, I am declaring that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. But then he says in verse 2, all things come alike to all. He's talking here in a very large sense. One event happens to the righteous and the wicked. In other words, the righteous and wicked are both born. They both are going to die. To the good, the clean, and the unclean, to him who sacrifices to God, to him who does not sacrifice. As it is good, or as is the good, so is the sinner. So he declares to begin with that outwardly speaking, on the surface, the main events of life are the same for those who are trying to follow God and those who simply have no interest in following God. Those who sacrifice and those who don't. Those who are good and those who are sinners. He who takes an oath as he who fears an oath. Now he's talking about a very large experience of being born and eventually dying. That bears out here very soon in this chapter. There is an evil in all that's done under the sun. So this is kind of an evil thing that of all of us that live on the earth, it appears evil that one thing happens to all, that eventually they find their way into a grave. Truly, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that they go to the dead. Now he's talking, obviously, in verse 3, that there are people in the hearts of men that are not trying to follow God. That essentially all people's hearts are evil. And he says, well, they all eventually die anyway. But for him who is joined to the living, there is hope. So if you are still alive, still joined to the living, there is hope. Hope, of course, that they'll repent. Hope of a better life to come, a better resurrection. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. Now, back in those years, some of the commentaries bring out that because of the social stratification, those who were rulers, kings, or wealthy were sort of called lions. And I think even the word lion might be used in some cases like that today. Well, that guy's a real lion, or he's the Lion of Judah, whatever, Lion of Britain. But those who were the rulers, the mayors, the towns, were sort of parenthetically referred to as lions. And those who were not were dogs. Even Jesus at one point used the comment about, well, should I give what's fit for the sons to the dogs? Of course, referring there to Gentiles, non-Israelites. But a living dog, a person who has a very low estate in life, is still better than a dead ruler because he has a chance to seek God's blessings. For the living know they will die. The dead know nothing, no conscience to them. They have no more reward. Whatever is going to be for them has been decided. For the memory of them is forgotten. Also their love, their hatred, their envy have now all perished. Now, it's not necessarily true for those that are righteous, because God says precious in his sight is the death of his saints. Their memory is not forgotten. It says in Psalm 112, the memory of God's righteous people are not forgotten. So that the memory of these evil people, at least as far as the rest of the world is concerned, is forgotten. Whatever they experienced, their love, their hatred, their envy, all that now is a thing of the past. It's perished. Nevermore will they have a share in anything done under the sun. So their chance is over. Verse 7 is very interesting because it says, go eat your bread with joy. This is advice from Solomon. Drink your wine with a merry heart. Enjoy life. For God has already accepted your works. Now what he is accepting here, or what he's addressing, is the question that people ask, are my accomplishments satisfactory to God? Is God happy with what I have? And in this case, he's talking about people who may look at their physical success as being an indication. That was still true in the time of the first century. Many of the Pharisees thought that the more you blessed, the more you obeyed God, or the more you were accepted by God, the higher you were in status, the higher you were in finances and blessings. And so the poor people were often despised as also being unrighteous people. But the question he's answering is, is my accomplishment, is God okay with what I've accomplished in my life? He says, God's already accepted your works. He's not saying he accepted your sin, but what has happened to you, whether you've had great business success whether you made some bad investments and, you know, lost money, lost your house, whatever. All these physical things we could look at. So God's not really that concerned with the works of your life, physically speaking. He says, let your garments be white, and let your head lack no oil. Now, Josephus, in his book Antiquities of the Jews, the section is 8-7 and also 3, Josephus records that Solomon always wore white, that he dressed in white robes, white garments continually, that he felt that was a way to honor God and a way to show the blessings he'd been given. But Solomon, if Josephus is correct, had the habit of always wearing white. White is sometimes called a token of joy, like in Isaiah chapter 61 and verse 3. But he was clothed in white. Jesus Christ talked about the lilies of the field being white, typical of spotless righteousness, or at least the cleanliness we can have through his forgiveness. So what Solomon is saying is, well, let your garments be white. Be worried more about your spiritual condition than whether or not God is satisfied with how many physical things or whatever you've done in this life that you may accomplish as being your trophies or your accomplishments. Just look, go ahead and eat your bread with joy. Don't second guess that. Drink enough wine, or at least drink some wine to have an enjoyable, merry heart. Doesn't say drunkenness. God always doesn't approve of that, of course. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life. Now, we have a lot of people that are striving to obey this in current times, which is great. It's good. Those who have a good marriage are very happy to see many others getting married and finding their life's companion. But he says, enjoy it. Live joyfully with the wife of your youth, whom you love, all the days of this temporary life which God has given you under the sun. All your days of vanity, because that is your portion in life. That's what God intends for us, is to have a spouse that helps us to enjoy life as a blessing that he gave, so that we can then understand that much of the rest of what we do doesn't have as much of an impact spiritually as what we might think. For in the labor which you perform under the sun. In other words, enjoy the labor you do together. They'll be more concerned with your righteous white garments than whether or not the physical things you do will cause God to approve you. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there's no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going. You only have a certain amount of time to accomplish all the things you want to accomplish. And of course, the most important thing is accomplishing, trying to seek God, learn his will, learn how his laws apply in our life, and resist those things that would tug us a different direction. Whatever your hand finds to do it with your might. There's no work or device or knowledge. You cannot gain anything after this life is over. I returned and saw under the sun. So Solomon is out viewing the countryside. He said, the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor the bread to the wise. He's talking about winning a race, winning a battle, having lots of bread, nor riches to men of understanding. Not just understanding, people have wealth, but people who don't have understanding have wealth. Nor favor to men of skill. He's earlier said none of these things really matter that much. Then he says, time and chance happens to them all. The verse on time and chance really refers to people that are striving for physical things. He's talking about here the race, trying to have bread, riches, and certainly that's true. How many people have been in the right place at the right time and won some sort of a lottery? Well, probably not most of us. God knows that'd be a curse for most of us. You know, how many people have been able to accomplish some of those things and then see those riches disappear? I heard a report recently that one-third of all of the lottery winners from the Washington State Lottery wish they had not won, that the money that they received caused a great deal of turmoil in their family. They lost relatives, had fights with all kinds of people. And from that time forward, people began looking at them not as people, but as big bank accounts. Look at how many times our professional athletes have huge amounts of money. And if they squander it, and it destroys the relationships and the character that they should have, but instead they're simply taken away. That's taken away from them by this huge money amount that they give. But the important thing that we understand here is that when he says time and chance happens to all, he's talking a lot about our physical character, not character, but physical surroundings, physical things that we have, physical things that are part of our life only temporarily. For a man does not know his time. Like fish taken in a cruel net, like birds caught in a snare, so the sons of men are snared with an evil time when it falls suddenly upon them. Notice he calls these people here sons of men, as opposed to those in chapter 9 and verse 1 that he calls the righteous. So I would submit that much of what he's talking about, especially about after verse 4, maybe even verse 3, he's talking about people who are not necessarily called by God, not the righteous, whose hands and whose works are in God's hands, but he's talking about just in general. He observes that people all around the world, that the race are not always to the one who tries the hardest, that riches are not always to the ones who are wisest, that you know, time and chance happens to them all. Now let's consider, though, the subject of what God says about his direction in our life. I don't want to go off in the wrong here and get too far. Any good idea taken to an extreme is a bad idea. And we all know people whose life is based on superstition. Let's go over to Psalm chapter 37. God does promise direction in our life. God promises that if we commit our way to him, he will direct our paths. And that's not necessarily the same as saying that God has decided our path ahead of time, or that God has only one person he wants us to meet somewhere and then marry, or that God has all of these decisions already made, and that we are somehow being tugged along on this conveyor belt with everything being done for us. God doesn't work that way. On the other hand, he does promise us protection. He promises us to give us extra help along the way. And oftentimes he does things, I believe, just out of kindness, that because we are his people, we are striving to seek his will and do his work, that he just, like a father who wants to give his son a special present, does some special things for us. In Psalm 37 and verse 23, it says, "The steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord." Now, Solomon very likely either wrote this, but he certainly read it. Maybe written by David or one of the earlier people. But David, Solomon understood very plainly that the steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord. Let's just say here, well, time and chance happens to all, no matter what happens to you, it's just all an accident. That's not the case at all. The steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord. The last half of that verse is, he delights in his way. God delights in every step we take that he approves of. Every step we take towards obedience. Every step we take towards doing his will first, and our own will secondly. Let's go back to the beginning of this psalm, verse 1 here of Psalm 37. David actually is very plain here about how much God will take care of us. He's very plain that there is no such thing, after a certain point, there's no such thing as time and chance happening to those who are following God. Because once we've been called, and even our death is special in his sight, we find that our life is also very special. We have protection. We have an access to our Creator that is not accessible, not available to most people. In Psalm 37 and verse 1, it says, "Do not fret because of evildoers." Obviously, in David's time, and even in our time, people wonder, why are evildoers in power? Why are there people in positions that can cause me to have this much suffering or pain or whatever it might be? You might be thinking of that when you fill out your taxes in the next month or two. And here we have all these people in Washington, D.C. who are squandering our money, and yet they have the power to take what we have. Don't fret because of evildoers, nor be envious of the workers of iniquity, for they shall soon be cut down like the grass, and wither as the green herb. We live in a world where there's a lot of iniquity. It's getting worse. Those who are perhaps under 20 don't comprehend as much as the old folks here, all of us, I would say, how much our society has changed in 30, 40, 50 years, 20 years. I was watching TV last Sunday morning just trying to find something. The remote control, you're trying to find a football game or something on Sunday morning, and there was Andy Griffith being interviewed on television. I used to love to watch Andy Griffith and Don Knotts and Gomer Pyle. Andy Griffith talked about how he had Guillain-Barre disease, I believe it was. He was paralyzed for 2 years, couldn't walk, couldn't move. He's through a lot of therapy, been able now to get up and walk around, do some things. And the interviewer asked him, when you were doing television, you were the biggest success, you had the biggest shows all during your time period, the early 60s, middle 1960s. So what is different now? And Andy Griffith said, when Don Knotts and Wilmer Pyle and I were doing television, our goal was to teach noble virtues. And he says today it's the exact opposite of that. So they've come so far away from actually teaching virtues, right and wrong, honesty, goodness, loyalty. So none of those things are being taught now. In fact, people are being taught the opposite of that. And so the interviewer says, well, how long will that last? And he just says, well, he shook his head. He says, I hope it stops, he said, because it's so damaging to our country. So we have a lot of evildoers in media, television. For those that have never grown up on Father Knows Best, can you imagine a show today called Father Knows Best? Andy Griffith and Don Knotts and all those people, Dick Van Dyke, who went to the same high school I did, obviously a lot of years earlier, but was from my hometown. That type of entertainer is almost gone today. You know, where are they? They're essentially dying off, or like Bill Cosby, being marginalized. Instead, we have a very different face that we are putting up to the world, because the world, unfortunately, watches all of our television, and it has been a tremendous reason why so many of them resent us. But we do have workers of iniquity. There's an old saying, when little people cast big shadows, the sun is about to set. Where are little people casting big shadows now? Well, how about this guy down in Venezuela, casting a big shadow over the entire continent of South America and our entire oil dependence? About Ahmadinejad over in Iran, a little man, 5'3", casting a big shadow of evil over an entire swath. And America has proven that he's behind much of the attacks in Iraq today, and we're powerless to stop him. You look around the world, and it's much like it was in the 1930s. Most of us can't remember the rise of Adolf Hitler, or Benito Mussolini, or the Marco in Spain, other places. But when little men start casting big shadows, the sun is about to set, and we may be upon the precipice of some very important events in world history that we'll someday look back upon and say, you know, why did I see that coming? Or at least we saw a part of it coming. But in the meantime, don't interpret that as God has left you as an individual, or that God is not in control of events. He says in verse 3, even in this atmosphere of evil workers doing evil things, trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and feed on his faithfulness. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he shall give you the desires of your heart. Now, how does God do that? This is one of the scriptures I whipped on my wife before she was my wife. And I said, well, see, you're the desire of my heart, so God says he's going to give me to you. You have no choice. You have to marry me. And so after a few months of hearing that, she gave in and said, yeah, I guess I will. I'm tired of you hearing it. And so that's about the last time I whipped the scripture on her, because the rest of them haven't worked too well. But that one worked. And it really is true. And there's nothing wrong with praying and saying, God, this is the desire of my heart. Just keep in mind what James says, that it should not be so selfishly that we consume it upon your own lust. And the desire of our heart really should be to preach God's truth, to have more and more people that understand what we do, to have God call more people into his family, into his kingdom. And the desire of our heart needs to be not only selfish, but much more than that, outward towards a much bigger work than just ourselves. Nothing wrong with desiring the right things for ourselves, as long as it's, you know, in line with obeying God and doing what he has planned for us, or what his will says we should be. Then he says, commit your way to the Lord, trust also in him, and he shall bring it to pass. Now, does that sound like time and chance happens to all? It really doesn't. It just really doesn't. But committing your way to the Lord doesn't mean, you know, God, please help me to win the lottery. You know, please help me sell my house, my car, my dog, and I'll invest it all in lottery tickets, and then you can help me win. That's not what it means. You commit your way to him. Primarily, you're committing yourself to be in his kingdom. You're committing yourself to be a good example as a Christian. You're committing yourself to obey these commandments all of your life. It says, he shall bring it to pass. He'll give you the help. But he also promises to give us little blessings along the way. It doesn't mean we won't get sick. It doesn't mean we won't ever have an accident. Whenever I visit Spokane, I think of all my wife's car accidents when she was here. driving on all this ice and snow. And it's not an easy place to drive when it gets full of ice and snow. Very thankfully, so there were never any injuries. They were all small. And you can always replace broken metal. You just can't replace broken people. So I was just always thankful that she's never been injured in any of the ice accidents. But I've also been pretty good about not letting her drive when it's been real icy since then. Because these women think they're supposed to put their brake on hard when they hit slippery ice. And you don't do that and keep control of your vehicle. And it's just a very difficult thing unless you grew up in ice and snow. It's just difficult not to do that. And in fact, on the way up over here yesterday, we were stopped in traffic for about an hour because of a serious accident on the freeway on I-5 in Tacoma where somebody apparently had done that, slipped on the ice and turned around and smashed up a couple vehicles. But notice it says, commit your way to the Lord and trust in him. Verse 6, he shall bring forth your righteousness as the light. So he's really talking about praying for righteousness, praying for being able to obey, and your justice as the noonday. So eventually the blessing that God will give you for seeking his righteousness will be like the sun shining at noon. Verse 7, rest in the Lord, wait patiently for him. We don't want to force our will and our time schedule on God. Sometimes we make a great mistake in doing that. We have made a great mistake in doing that, and when it comes to prophecy being fulfilled, we like to think we can write names and dates in the scriptures. Everybody does that. It's not a great sin. It's just that, we're anxious. And this is how it could work out. It ought to work out. Oh, yeah, Franz Josef Strauss could be the beast. The problem is he died back in the late 70s, so he couldn't be the beast now. And so we have all these names and things and ways we'd like to have it work out, but we've learned the lesson, I hope, to wait patiently for God, and he will do things in his own time, in his own way. Do not fret because of him who prospers in his way. Don't get worried because of people who might have more or on the surface it looks like they're being blessed. So don't worry about that. Because of the man who brings wicked schemes to pass. And we have evidence of that all around us from time to time in politics and other things. Cease from anger, forsake wrath. Don't be angry because someone's estate in life that you perceive as being someone who's not righteous or following God, that is better than yours. Just don't worry about it. Don't forget 1 Corinthians 1, where God says he calls the weak of the world, not the high, not the heady, not the wealthy. But he calls basically, just like he did during his time, those uneducated Galileans that the Pharisees accused them of being. Turned out they were actually fairly educated people, especially the way they wrote and spoke. But still, we are not the great wonders of the earth. Bill Gates is not here. No great politicians are here. It's just us average people. So cease from anger. Verse 9, evildoers shall be cut off. Those who wait on the Lord shall inherit the earth. So once again, he's focusing on the desire of our hearts as being in God's kingdom and eventually inheriting the earth. Yet a little while, and the wicked shall be no more. And that's very comforting in a world that is becoming increasingly wicked. Yet a little while, and the wicked will be no more. Indeed, you will look carefully for his place. There's going to be coming a time when you'll have to search long and hard to find a wicked person. And, of course, that'll be during the millennium. Notice verse 11, the meek shall inherit the earth. And that, of course, is a promise that Jesus Christ himself gave in the Sermon on the Mount. The meek shall inherit the earth, and they shall delight themselves in the abundance of peace. There'll be a time when there really is peace, a time when there is something that most of us today can't comprehend because we've never really had complete peace, either in our personal lives or in the society around us, except that we understand God is working with us. We have the peace that passes all understanding, which is the result of having the Spirit of God. Let's go over now to Proverbs chapter 3. Proverbs chapter 3, a very commonly read chapter at summer camps or any of our youth activities. I'd like to encourage all of the young adults and teens who are here, and even those of us who still have days left and things to accomplish. This applies to everyone, not just those who are younger. But as you look upon the landscape of your life, most of us are beyond the place of choosing a career or choosing our basic education level that we are going to achieve. We're simply fulfilling what we've already been doing and going through the same motions and steps, but trying to improve, trying to accomplish more. But it says very plainly here in Proverbs chapter 3, my son, don't forget my law. Let your heart keep my commands. For length of days and long life and peace they will add to you. I don't believe he's talking about supernaturally. I think what he's talking about here is that if you obey God's commands, you keep yourself from a lot of turmoil. You keep yourself from a lot of trouble. That length of days and long life and peace will add to you. The number one factor in long life today is whether or not a person is married. Those who are married the longest tend to live the longest. And those that have rewarding marriages tend to live much, much longer than those perhaps that have rocky or challenging relationships. But more and more, our society around us is seeing the physical benefits, not just the spiritual, but the physical benefits of the marriage unit that God created. I'm reading a book that was recommended to me, actually given to me by Mr. Chester in Portland. It's called A General Theory of Love, one of the bestsellers of the last couple of years, I guess, where the three scientists that wrote it, three psychologists, discuss how the human mind works and getting these love relations, how it bonds, how mothers bond with their babies, how babies' brains grow and all these various sections of the brain, how they work, interact, and all those various things. And I'm not a doctor, so I don't understand it all. But they're coming up with some very interesting observations about relationships and how the brain works and this bonding between a husband and wife that they said is beyond the comprehension of science, about how they can look at each other and know what each other is thinking without any words ever being said. Did you ever have your wife look at you and said, "What did you buy?" You ever had your wife ask you that? You walk in the house, kind of a sheepish look on your face, and, "Okay, what did you buy?" "Well, another dog." And so my wife asked me, "Okay, well, another dog?" So we're hoping to have puppies and get back some of this money so I don't get divorced. She wouldn't divorce me for dogs. But my wife just never understood my relationship with my dogs, just the way it is. She grew up on a farm. They had dogs. All dogs were named Rufus. And Rufus, about once a year, ran out on the road and got ran over, so Dad went to the pound, got another dog that looked a lot like Rufus, and named him Rufus, and she had about 8 Rufuses growing up, and they were like chickens and cattle, you know, and pigs. They just, when it came their time to die on the road, it was their time to die. I said, "Well, why don't you just put a fence up? We didn't have money for a fence in time, and, you know, the dog stayed in the backyard most of the time." So I grew up with a dog that I really loved and, you know, bonded with and talked with and had a relationship with, and so my wife has never understood my relationship with my dogs. None of my dogs are named Rufus, by the way. Just thought I'd tell you that. I would never name a dog that because of the mortality likelihood. But still, the scientists are understanding that a husband and wife, after they live together and have this bonded relationship, they grow to where there is more to it. They call it, there's a substance there of the relationship that science cannot understand. Something else they are learning is that the intimate relationship of marriage, what God calls the two becoming one flesh, creates a bond if there is no scar tissue in the way. The scientists have now discovered that once a person, unmarried, has had a sexual relationship with 7 other people, they are no longer able to bond through that relationship. It becomes no more than just shaking hands, you know, a hug, whatever. The supernatural, really it is supernatural, and the next time I come I'll bring the book, but at any rate, the supernatural development of this relationship between a husband and wife, which is very similar, by the way, to a mother and newborn child, to where they're able to read each other's eyes and facial expressions, and the mother sort of knows what the baby needs before the baby even cries, various things. But that supernatural bonding that God designed to take place in the limbic form of our brain, there are 3 parts of your brain, and the reptilian, which is just the base stem, all reptiles have that. The limbic section is the next section, kind of the middle part of your brain. Maybe some of this is real small. But then there's the larger cognitive section, which then is, you know, thought processes, a lot to do with memory, a lot to do with reasoning power. And according to these scientists, of course, who are evolutionists, wrote the book, show how the things, they mentioned dogs, because dogs have this limbic system that other animals don't. Therefore, dogs are able to bond with us because we also have a limbic system. Ours, of course, much bigger. But they go through all these parts of the brain and how they work when this bonding takes place between a husband and wife. So when God says to rejoice with the wife of your youth, you think about that from a medical standpoint, that if you marry the girl or the man you love when you're younger and you don't have scar tissue in the way, you develop a relationship that is beyond, frankly, the comprehension of modern-day science. They know what happens, but that connection, that bonding that God designed to be a type of Christ in the church, because we are bonded with him in spirit. We are bonded with him in a way through prayer, through Bible study, through his working in our life that we don't understand because, you know, time and chance doesn't happen to us after we are called by Christ. After we have God's calling, we are baptized, we acknowledge that relationship, and that bonding develops slowly and gradually. And as we see God working in our life, we realize, you know what, there's something more here than just me getting up in the morning every day. Not that every single thing you do, you know, eating cereal instead of fried eggs, that doesn't mean God decided that. What we know, though, is that God is fulfilling his prophecy here, his promise to us. He says in verse 5, trust in the Lord with all your heart, lean not to your own understanding, and all your ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct your paths. We constantly talk about this at summer camp, that God will direct our paths. But it isn't just true at summer camp, it's true of all of us. And it does tell us that our life is not just thrown out there as happenstance and time and chance, but there really is a guidance that God has given to us. Let's go over to Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 5. Jesus Christ promised very plainly that he would never leave us and forsake us. Never. For those of us about 10, 12 years ago, 13, 14 years ago, that had to fight a great battle of holding on to the truth and not allowing that truth that we had given so much for to be taken, there were some very dark days. There were some days when our faith was questioned. There were some days, some nights, when we couldn't sleep. There were some very challenging months. In fact, in some cases, several years, not knowing what would happen. But the truth of the matter is, it really wasn't time and chance because God's hand never left those who were trying to follow him. And God's hand is still on us today. He says in Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 5, let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have, for he himself said, I will never leave you and forsake you. So look, don't worry about being covetous, about trying to get more. If you've lost a lot, if you haven't gained what you think you should, don't worry about it. Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content because God has said, I will never leave you or forsake you. Now, where did God say that? Well, he said it to Joshua. Deuteronomy 31, Moses told Joshua, look, God says he will never leave you or forsake you. In 1 Chronicles 28, God told it to David. And David told Solomon, God will never leave you or forsake you. To leave means to slacken or let up. God will never let up. To forsake means to leave behind. That's what the Hebrew word actually means. God will never leave you behind. Don't ever think that he's gone and you simply are left alone. Because that is certainly not the case. Let's go over now to Acts chapter 14. At least one example of Paul that we all are very familiar with. In this case, chapter 14, on the surface, looks like a big failure. How many of us, how many of you have tried over and over for this great project? You worked on it. Maybe it's going to be studying something, learning something, writing something, whatever it might be. But, you know, you want to accomplish X, Y, and Z. So you work hard, you try, you prepare, and everything goes flat. Doesn't work. Does that mean it was a failure from God's standpoint? Acts chapter 14 and verse 1, Paul is just beginning his work. He's just beginning to be a preacher traveling throughout the Roman world. His first efforts did not turn out all that well. Chapter 14 and verse 1, it happened at Iconium. They went to the synagogue of the Jews, spoke to a great multitude of both Jews and the Greeks, and some of them believed. But the unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles and poisoned their minds against the brethren. Therefore they stayed there a long time, speaking boldly in the Lord, who was bearing witness to the world of his grace, granting signs and wonders to be done by their hands. So very powerful preaching. God allowed them to perform miracles, or he did miracles because of what they had done. But the multitude of the city was divided, sided part with the Jews and part with the apostles. Then a violent attempt was made by both the Gentiles and Jews with their rulers to abuse them and stone them. They became aware of it, and they fled to Lystra and Derbe, cities in Lycaonia and the surrounding region. So they were basically run out of town by the Jews and by those Gentiles who opposed them. Verse 7, they were preaching the gospel there, and in Lystra a certain man without strength in his feet was sitting, a cripple from his mother's womb who had never walked. This man Paul heard speaking. Observing him intently, seeing he had a faith, healed him, or said to him, stand up on your feet. But the same thing happened. People started first calling them gods. Eventually, they were sent out of the city and stoned. In verse 22, it simply says, they exhorted the other people there, paraphrasing, saying, we must, for many tribulations, enter the kingdom of God. Now, eventually, some churches were raised up in these areas, but at first effort, this was a failure. It didn't look like things had gone very well. Oftentimes, we think things aren't going well, and yet behind the scenes, God is working in our life to help us to understand that He is there, and He's doing something much bigger for us, much better for us, than what we had even planned. 3 years ago, or 2 years ago, I guess it was, maybe it was three, two and a half, my wife and I were going to the feast over in Italy. Now, from the time I was small, I loved my grandfather, Ratinetti, who had been born in Italy. He died when I was about 9 years old, but I always cherish the memories of my grandfather, who, when he had died, was making me a motorized go-kart. I had seen movies of my mother and father's trip in the 1950s, 1952, 53, over to northern Italy, this little tiny village in the Alps north of Torino, where my grandfather was born. And these little black and white movies, my brother was a little baby, my older brother. I always wanted to go back. So when we were going to go to Italy, I called my Aunt Mary, who's 87, the last of the Ratinetti clan. She was married to my Uncle Joe, who's now dead. And I was able to get my grandfather Ratinetti's Ellis Island papers. I was able to get the entire family history and who was married to who. And, of course, my grandfather's parents had immigrated in 1903. And two brothers had married two sisters, so I was anxious to have an Alberto Ratinetti who was, you know, married to a Villaron. Maria Villaron was the lady's name. Got some information from my mother. And so we decided to go over to the feast, but of course I had this trip all planned out. Every day we were going to fly first to London, and we had to go to this airport in Stansted. My daughter Bridget had the tickets for us, and she said, it's only an hour up there, you get there quick, and you fly down to Milan, and then you can go over to see that part of Torino and go up in the Alps and try to find a little town there. And so guess what? We got to London, and this little airport called Stansted is 4 hours out of London by bus, not 1 hour. So we get in this bus. I thought, okay, this whole trip is starting out bad. And I'm Mr. Impatient. I'm telling Patty, this is really tough. So we get to this little Stansted airport, and first I call Bridget, upset with her, said, you were wrong about this airport. This is 4 hours out of London. It's way almost to Scotland, seemed like it wasn't. So she said, oh, don't worry, Dad. There's all kinds of planes going back and forth. You'll get a plane to Milan easily, you know. So we got there. I'm getting a little bit anxious, getting a little bit upset, realizing my entire itinerary had gone out the window. And then, of course, this airline in England says, oh, no, we can't get you anywhere down there. The closest town we can get you to is Venice. And then we spent like 9 hours in this little tiny rotten airport with little airplanes going in and out. So we finally flew down to Venice. Now, I had to be in Milan for atonement. They only gave us one day. But since we were late getting to Venice, and Venice is all the way across Italy, we looked on the map and we thought, well, we simply can't get to Murillo on Thursday and Friday, so we'll have to go later. So we spent 2 days in Venice, which my wife thought was great. We were bumming around Venice and eating lasagna, drinking red wine. We got in the train, went to Milan, where I spoke on the Day of Atonement. So I seized upon the idea of renting a car in Milan and going over to Torino and then up in the mountains to Murillo to find my grandfather's relatives. Well, the Italians were preparing for what's called the Olympics. And the way they do that is they just simply destroy the entire interstate highway and then rebuild it about 1 mile at a time over the next 5 years. So I had my day all planned out. We were going to get up, rent a car at 8 in the morning. We were going to get to Murillo by 10. We were going to see all these things, get back home by a certain time, and get back on the train, go down to the feast. So the whole way through northern Italy, I'm driving this crazy car with crazy people all around. My wife wasn't crazy. But there are no road signs. It had all been taken down. All you could do is follow the signs to a town. So I'd point to, well, the next town going west is called whatever. We go to these roundabouts, there's little tiny signs going this way, this, and all there are towns with an arrow. No mileage, no kilometers, anything. So I'm just really fuming. I bet this whole trip is ruined. This is a rotten deal. You know, we're going to have no time at all. And everything's gone wrong, the plane fight. We finally took us 4 hours to travel about 120 miles over there. And so we finally went to this little town there in Campolano. I found out how to get up the little tiny one-lane road up in the mountains to Murillo. So we finally got up there on Sunday afternoon. This is great, you know. 4 hours till dark, 3 hours till dark, you know, and nowhere to stay tonight, and can't go back because the roads aren't drivable, and I was just fuming the whole time. You ever do that? Ever go on a trip where everything's going wrong? So we walked around a little town there, a little square about the size of this room with one little tavern, and found a couple that spoke English. We were able to go down to the church, and the priest there was a real nice little fellow. He just woke up. He let me go through all the verse books from baptismal records, and I found my grandfather's baptismal record from 1899. I found my great-grandparents back in the 1860s, their baptismal records. I was able to, the copy machine didn't work, I was able to take pictures of them. And then we walked around town, and then we went down to the cemetery. I thought, well, I will at least try to find, since we couldn't find any rat netties that knew any of my relatives, I thought, well, let's go down to the cemetery, I'll take pictures of all the rat netty statues, or all the monuments, and I'll take them home to my mom and ask them who was who. Now, the problem is, all rat netties are either Antonio or, is it Umberto? And all the Villarons are either Maria, either Anna Maria, or what's the other one? I forget. I'll tell you in a minute. But they're all the same. So this kind of cemetery, there's like seven couples buried that are the exact same name as my grandparents. But, you know, it's Umberto Ratinetti and Anna Maria Villaron. So I ran a film, and now it's getting dark. And I thought, this is awful. I can't even take pictures of these monuments, of all these gravestones in this little town in Moralia. So I walked back down the town square, got one more, had one roll of film left in that car. I told Patty to wait. So I went back, and it's sort of getting dark. It's not yet dark, but it's sunset. And I'm thinking this whole trip has been, you know, good. I got to see the priest, but haven't found any relatives. And so I went over and took a picture of the very last Ratinetti Villaron statue, took the picture of my last roll, and his voice behind me says, "Are you from the States?" I turned around, and there's this girl about this tall, dark hair, looks strikingly like my daughter Bridget. And I said, "Yes, we're from Washington State." She says, "Well, I have relatives in the States, in Florida." And I said, "Oh, really? What are the names?" She says, my relative's name Leo Tube. I said, "Leo Tube is my great uncle." And this girl had come from Torino. She's my fifth cousin. And she had only come down to visit her grandmother once a month. She only comes on Sunday afternoon late, and she normally comes to decorate flowers in the grave after she visits her mother, her grandmother, Marguerite. But because it was getting late and she was running late, she came to the cemetery first. And after I took that last picture, we were going to get in the car and leave. So if anything had gone right on my trip, I would never have met my fifth cousin, Deborah. We went down, she introduced me to I think she'd be my third great aunt. Anyway, she was my great grandmother's sister, Marguerite. And then I guess it would have been my second cousin came there named Pietro. He gave us some wine from the Ratinetti Vineyard, told us all the history of the town and all the Ratinettis and how these married couples had gone to the States and wanted to come back. And we had just a great time. We went into one little resort town there and met another uncle and some cousins. And we've kept up contact ever since, and she sends us family pictures. We send her family pictures. Unfortunately, my aunt Marguerite died. She was about 89, I believe. She died last year. So had I not gone and met her, we wouldn't have never met her. We simply never would have. And she remembered my mother. The first thing she said to me through my cousin, who knew English and Italian, she said, "Why didn't your mother write me?" Because my mother had been there in 1953. Now, how am I supposed to know why my mother didn't write her when I wasn't even born yet? But you have to understand Italian women. It was I think, one of the highlight experiences of my entire life. And I think it was just one of those things where God has said, you know, Rex has been through a lot of tough things in his life, and, you know, I understand all this, so I'm going to do something nice for him. I'm going to ruin his entire trip, but I'm going to make it worthwhile because he will meet a cousin and part of the Ratinetti family that he never would possibly have met otherwise. And so the lesson I learned there is that even when things are really going wrong, when you think everything is going wrong, don't forget there's a much higher power that is acting in your life. That there is a God up there who knows what is best for you, knows what is best for your eternal life, and knows what is best for you at this moment. And even though we think things might be going wrong, we might be testing our patience, we might be even, you know, getting a little frustrated, wishing things were happening, don't ever forget there is a higher power controlling your life that wants to bless you, wants you to obey, wants things to go well, and knows far more than you do about all the circumstances in the entire world and how things are going to play out. And because of that, I think I've gained a better understanding that after we are called by God, time and chance does not necessarily happen to us all.